مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
Good morning to all our listeners. You are tuned into Iran radio broadcast from Tehran. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. The Islamic world produced the first skilled, specially trained pharmacists who made their own medicines and worked closely with medical doctors and physicians. A 13th century Islamic writer described the circulation of blood inside the human body some 400 years before this was discovered in Europe. One famous hadith Islamic saying is, Allah is beautiful and loves beauty. Beauty has always been, therefore, very important to Muslims and develops in the virtual arts such as architecture, calligraphy, painting, textile, metalwork, and ceramists were encouraged. On the continuation of Iran Radio, we'll listen to this part. We start off this hour's programs with our news bulletin. That will be followed by the Ocean of Dua. The program explains supplications and prayers taken from various books such as Mafatihul Jinan and Kamilu Ziyarat. And we round up this hour with our varied radio productions feature.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says so-called talks with the United States are nothing but dictation under pressure. Iran's foreign minister has criticized the European Troika for shifting positions and presenting excessive demands by some Western countries regarding Tehran's nuclear program. The Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip claims more civilian lives as the besieged territory is pounded by the regime's indiscriminate air and artillery strikes. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says so-called talks with the United States are nothing but dictation under pressure. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, speaking at the start of the new academic year, said America's goal is to strip Iran of its independence by first targeting its nuclear energy, then missiles, and eventually every aspect of national sovereignty. The leader noted that the U.S. has repeatedly violated its commitments, including those within the 2015 nuclear deal, so it cannot be trusted. He said negotiations under coercion are harmful. Ayatollah Khamenei stressed that the path forward is strengthening Iran's scientific, military, and economic power. He said only a strong nation can deter aggression and protect its dignity, warning that reliance on the U.S. or Western powers is a dangerous illusion. Political analyst Fawad Izadi says Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei's message to American politicians is their political maneuvers and deceptive tactics will ultimately prove ineffective.
He has given his opinion with regard to the future of U.S.-Iran relations. That future looks at the U.S. track record. It looks at the recent war against Iran, the fact that Iran was negotiating with the United States when the United States attacked Iran 2 days before the next round of negotiations. So I think this is a message for American politicians. If they think they can get away with murder, they killed more than 1,000 Iranians a few months ago, mostly civilians. If they think they can trick their way through this type of deception operations, if they think they can use propaganda to influence public opinion in Iran and achieve their goals in that manner, they are going to be fully surprised by realizing that these type of policies and actions are not going to bear fruit.
Iran's foreign minister has criticized the European Troika for shifting positions and presenting excessive demands by some Western countries regarding Tehran's nuclear program. Abbas Araghchi made the criticism during a meeting with his Irish counterpart, Simon Harris, on the sidelines of the 80th session of the UN General Assembly. Araghchi said the approach adopted by the E3 is in contrast to the claim that they abide by diplomacy. In a separate meeting with the IAEA chief, Araghchi underscored the importance of sustaining diplomacy and preventing escalation of tensions. The top Iranian diplomat also met with Norwegian Prime Minister Jonas Gahr Støre. In that meeting, the two sides exchanged views on regional and international developments, Iran's nuclear program, and the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Araghchi also held meetings with top officials from Cyprus, Spain, and Qatar on the sidelines of the UNGA. Iran slams the United States for systematic harassment of its diplomats and increasing restrictions on them amid the 80th session of the UN General Assembly in New York. Foreign Ministry spokesman Ismail Baghaei issued the condemnation in a post on his ex social media account. He said the restrictions have prevented the Iranian diplomats from attending key multilateral meetings this week. Baghaei underlined that the U.S. move is in blatant violation of Washington's obligations under the UN Headquarters Agreement. He added that the restrictions show the extent of the U.S. animosity towards Iranians. The U.S. State Department has announced that it decided to impose maximum pressure on Iran and restrict the Iranian delegation's movement in New York. The Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip claims more civilian lives as the besieged territory is pounded by the regime's indiscriminate air and artillery strikes. One of the latest attacks killed nearly 24 Palestinians after a shelter for displaced people was bombed near a market in Gaza City. 4 civilians were killed after a family home was hit in the Al-Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza. Fatalities were reported after the regime's forces opened fire on a gathering of displaced people in the vicinity of a clinic in the Al-Shati refugee camp west of Gaza City. Separate Israeli strikes killed at least 5 Palestinians in the southern and central parts of Gaza. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees said a dozen of its facilities in Gaza City have been hit last week, including 9 schools and 2 health centers. The death toll from the Israeli genocide now exceeds 65,380, with nearly 167,000 others injured. Well, in an address to the 80th session of the United Nations General Assembly, the Colombian president has rebuked his U.S. counterpart over the genocidal war on Gaza. Gustavo Petro says Donald Trump is complicit in the genocide against Palestinians.
U.S. President Donald Trump allows missiles to be launched at children, young people, women, and the elderly in Gaza. He becomes complicit in genocide because it is genocide, and we must shout it again and again. This chamber is a silent witness and an accomplice to a genocide in today's world.
President Petro called on nations worldwide to unify their military resources to protect the Palestinian people and work toward the liberation of Palestine. His sentiments were echoed by the president of South Africa, who also used the UNGA platform to urge the international community to put an end to the Israeli crimes in Gaza.
We cannot and should not accept that members of this organization continue willfully to violate without consequence the charter that we have all agreed to uphold. Therefore, as nations that have pledged to uphold the UN Charter, we have the ultimate responsibility to ensure and protect the rights of the Palestinian people to self-determination, consistent with the case that South Africa brought before the International Court of Justice. There is growing global consensus that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. Just last week, the United Nations Independent International Commission of Inquiry found that Israel is responsible for the commission of genocide in Gaza. Palestinians continue to face genocide and famine. We have a duty to act.
Ramaphosa referred to a recent report by the UN Independent International Commission of Inquiry confirming that Israel has committed genocide in the besieged territory. The South African president also lashed out at the UN Security Council, saying it has become ineffective in carrying out its mandate to maintain global peace and security and needs to change its structure. He expressed his country's deep concern about the Security Council's failure to ensure accountability and uphold international law. The president of Lebanon also addressed the session, urging global action to stop the Israeli genocide in Gaza.
We call for the immediate cessation of Israeli aggression, the full withdrawal of its occupying forces from all Lebanese territory, and the release of our hostages that we shall not forget nor leave behind. And we insist on the complete implementation of UN Security Council Resolution 1701. It is our moral, human, and political obligation to call for an immediate end to the devastation taking place in Gaza. We urge the revival of a new political track aimed at finding a just and permanent solution to the Palestinian question based on the resolutions of international legitimacy.
On the day that the UN General Assembly debates began, protests in New York expressed rage over the continuous genocide against the Palestinians at the hands of the Israeli occupation. While world leaders were meeting, our correspondent Rachel Hamdoun has more on the story.
Assembly will hear.
While presidents and leaders took the podium during the UNGA high-level week in New York, activists and demonstrators protested the UNGA debates as the people of Gaza continue to be ethnically cleansed by the Israeli occupation and the world remains watching. Banners condemning the UN's negligence towards preserving international law were held high among the crowd, alongside the complicity of the U.S. in the forced starvation of the Palestinian people and the sale of weapons to the occupation killing the Palestinians.
After 2 years of genocide, most of the world has come to realize that it is in fact a genocide, except the United States and Israel, of course. And the U.S. is, Trump is speaking today, which is a mockery of anything.
The protest today at the UN is mostly about the fact that Benjamin Netanyahu is down here and there's going to be talks about how Israel and the U.S. are going to respond, which is most likely going to lead to full annexation of the West Bank. We are also protesting the fact that multiple states or multiple countries have now recognized a Palestinian state, which, while it is one step forward, is not full liberation. You know, you can't recognize that the knife is there without fully pulling it out and healing the wound.
As world leaders gather at the UN headquarters here in New York to discuss various issues, the urgency of Gaza's situation is highlighted by protesters surrounding the building. These protesters are demanding the protection of Palestinians. They are demanding the end of the Gaza siege and the liberation of Palestine.
Demonstrators also criticize the double standards and selective protection that the international body stands for when it comes to preaching about women's rights, but Palestine is often overlooked.
What kind of values do you stand for? Like you just said, there's pregnant women, there's babies being killed, there's no access to menstrual supplies. How can you be human if you're not letting these, if not letting aid in, not stopping the occupation? It's ridiculous.
It's all of our rights. It's women's rights, it's children's rights, it's human rights, it's really planet rights. Like, we're, by not protecting one community of people, we're really not protecting any of us because it's a chain reaction. And when you fail to protect someone, you're really failing to protect yourself. And I think they have to remember that.
More protests are planned to occur for the length of the high-level week, calling for the freedom of Palestine from occupation and the preservation of the Palestinian identity. Rachel Hamdouin, New York.
The Global Samud Flotilla, which is en route to Gaza to break the Israeli siege of the territory, reports that it has been once again attacked by drones. Well, the flotilla said in a statement that more than 15 drones hovered above the Alma boat at low altitude, appearing roughly every 10 minutes. It said that one of the drones dropped a substance with a smell of gunpowder on a ship while another drone fired a projectile which fell into the sea. The flotilla also reported multiple explosions and communication jamming, noting that the incident was apparently aimed at intimidating the activists and gathering intelligence for Israel. The statement said the lengths to which Israel and its allies will go to prolong the genocide in Gaza are sickening, but their tactics will not deter the activists from delivering aid to Gaza and breaking its illegal siege. It stressed that every attempt to intimidate the activists only strengthens their commitment, as they will not remain silent and will continue to sail. The Hamas resistance movement says it has never been an obstacle to reaching a ceasefire agreement in the Gaza Strip. The movement's remarks came in response to U.S. President Donald Trump's recent claims that the movement is the party refusing the Gaza truce. Hamas said the U.S. administration, the mediators, and the entire world know that Israel's war criminal prime minister is the only party obstructing all attempts to reach an agreement. Hamas said it has always been flexible and positive regarding the efforts made to end the Gaza war. It also pointed out Tel Aviv's recent bombing of the headquarters of the movement's negotiating delegation in Qatar while they were discussing Trump's latest proposal. Hamas called on the U.S. to intervene positively to force the terrorist regime of Israel to end its crimes of genocide, ethnic cleansing, and forced displacement against Palestinians. It also urged Washington to stop providing political and military cover for Israel's brutal war on Gaza. Political commentator Tony Gosling says not only the U.S. but all the Western media outlets are portraying Hamas as a terrorist organization, while Israel is the real terrorist.
Well, it's not just Donald Trump, is it? It's the
so-called reality in the entire Western press, which is talking about Hamas as a terrorist organisation. We've got this bizarre situation here in Britain where the Palestine Action, the non-violent group which has been trying to stop the genocide by closing down those who are supplying weapons to the Israelis, they have been proscribed, as Hamas, as a terrorist organisation, supposedly, whereas the British government are also trying to recognise the state of Palestine, and they've just done so. So what is going on here is Hamas are being singled out, even though they are, from 2006, the elected government, the majority of Palestinian people in Gaza. So there is a complete hypocrisy at the heart, of, it seems to me, of much of what we're hearing. So the Palestinians are the ones who are the victims, and they're being painted as terrorists. Actually, the real terrorists in this conflict are, of course, the Israelis, who are using, abusing and misusing all the weapons of war against civilian populations.
Yes.
And they're trying to frame the Palestinian population as if they are Hamas.
A group of UN experts has called on the International Federation of Football Association, FIFA, and Europe's Football Association, UEFA, to suspend Israel from football events over its crimes in Gaza. The UN experts said in a statement that national teams, which represent entities that commit massive human rights violations, should be suspended. They added that suspending Israel is a necessary response to address the ongoing genocide in Gaza. The experts also urged countries that host international organizations and sporting competitions not to remain neutral in the face of genocide. Their remarks came after comments by former Manchester United star Eric Cantona, who denounced what he called the double standards enjoyed by Israel. He said 4 days after Russia started the war in Ukraine, FIFA and UEFA suspended Russia. But after over 700 days of genocide, Israel continues to be allowed to participate. Author and journalist Sakina Dautu joined us earlier. She explained how the international sports bodies and fans can take action to stop the Israeli genocide in Gaza.
It's a very powerful message. Not only is it coming from the UN experts, but, you know, this group of a lot of people, including fans, activists, they're also supporting this initiative, you know, the No Game Over initiative, is there to ensure that Israel is not allowed to play in any of the international sports, and particularly, I think, in football. I think what is important is to know that actually the heads of these football federations, they do have the authority. People are waiting for FIFA and UEFA to take action. But even, you know, before we go to FIFA and UEFA, these heads of football associations themselves have the authority. Now, I think this fact was not always known, because this is a bottom-up initiative to ensure that the fans can actually influence this. We have been seeing in the past few months that whenever there is a football match and Israel is playing, fans usually go there and they are against the Israeli teams. So I think by this initiative, by putting it together, it is giving voices to ordinary people who really feel frustrated by all this propaganda. And I think it is a very powerful way of tackling a nation like Israel. Of course, you mentioned, you know, this was the same case in apartheid South Africa. What it does, I think what sports does, is it brings ordinary people to take the action.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Can we not see how the planets look like diamonds in the sky? And everything on earth was created for you and I. Can we not see? Merely waiting for the final day to arrive.
Ocean of Dua.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على محمد وآله الطاهرين.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the Ocean of Dua. And in this version of the program, we are trying to cover some of the names of the Almighty Allah that are recommended to be recited to invoke Him for obtaining benefits. So stay with us.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum wa al'an alahum ajma'in.
Among the names of the Almighty Allah that could be recited while we're invoking Him is the name Al-Witr. The word Witr means the one, but in this case it could be translated into the unique. So the Almighty Allah is unique in any aspect and any sense. That name being said, we move further on to the next name of the Almighty Allah, which is Al-Wali. You may know that the word Wali has many different meanings, But in this case, it could be translated into the friend. It also has the translation of guardant and guardian, but we're not talking about them in this program. Of course, all the things we are mentioning in this program, dear listeners, have some different conditions to be met if we want to achieve the results. But whatever happens, reciting these names of the Almighty Allah will bring more the attraction of the Almighty Allah, and we can gain more benefits, especially while we are invoking Him and reciting dua.
والحمد لله على عفوه بعد قدرته والحمد لله على طول أناته في غضبه وهو قادر على ما يريد الحمد لله خالق الخلق باسط الرزق فالق الإصباح ذي الجلال والإكرام والفضل والإنعام الذي بعد فلا يرى وقرب فشهد النجوى.
Another name of the Almighty Allah, dear listeners, is Al-Wakil. Al-Wakil means the protector. And some scholars believe that this is an all-purpose dua, since the Almighty Allah will be the protector of us in every aspect and every direction. And whatever we do or wherever we want to go or whoever we want to contact with, the Almighty Allah will be the protector of the servant. Of course, provided that the servant believes that the Almighty Allah is the one and He is the protector. Some also recite this dua a lot. Hasbunallah wa ni'mal wakil. Allah suffices us, and what a protector He is. It means that He is the best kind of protector, so He suffices us. With Him being the protector, we're not going to need anyone or anything else to rely on. That's why the scholars say this is an all-purpose dua. And as for the last name of the Almighty Allah to be discussed in this program, the name Al-Wafi. It doesn't have a one-word equivalent in English, dear listeners, but it could be translated into the one who keeps the promise, the one who holds on to the promise he or she has made. So the Almighty Allah is Wafi in any sense, and since He has had many promises, He's saying that I am true in these promises, I'm not going to turn back from them. So the only thing in this case is needed is a true servant who is willing to keep up with the Almighty Allah and not to break his or her connection with Him. He is Wafi, He is the one who keeps the promise.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim, He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad, He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javob onjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy of God will come towards you.
Paradise, thank you Allah, that we're here, feeling so good, about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true.
ocean of dua.
Dear brothers and sisters, this fact has been mentioned many times previously, that if the person, if a servant, is looking for the Almighty Allah's favors and mercies, he or she has to try to be the like of them. The closer we get to the Almighty Allah, the closer we get to the prophets of the Almighty Allah and the infallible imams, the closer we are to the Almighty Allah's mercy and favors. And the Almighty Allah loves the person, the servant, who is the like of him. Of course, we know we cannot be the like of the infallibles, but at least we should try to some extent be the like of him. And we should hold on to the promises we have made with the Almighty Allah. Of course, all the things we are mentioning in this program, dear listeners, have some different conditions to be met if we want to achieve the results. But whatever happens, reciting these names of the Almighty Allah will bring more the attraction of the Almighty Allah, and we can gain more benefits, especially while we are invoking Him and reciting dua. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
IRIB English Radio.
There are activists who do not just challenge systems, they confront them head on. They blur the lines between protest and provocation, pushing public discourse into uncomfortable but necessary territory. Their work is often polarizing, but it's rooted in a deep conviction to dismantle injustice. My guest today is one such activist. Welcome to SOAP. I am Bahman Uray.
Calla Walsh is an American political activist, writer and organizer known for her outspoken views on U.S. foreign policy, anti-imperialism and Palestinian solidarity. She is a member of the Democratic Socialists of America and co-chair of the National Network on Cuba. Walsh has contributed to different media outlets and has participated in delegations to Cuba and Syria. In 2023, she was arrested during direct actions targeting Elbit Systems, an Israeli military contractor, as part of a work with Palestine Action US.
Calla Walsh, it's a pleasure to have you on SOAP.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
I'm going to talk about your experience with Cuba and what drew you to Cuba as a focal point for solidarity work.
I learned about Cuba as a teenager. I read many books about Cuba, and I didn't even realize it was possible to travel there. And once I started learning about, Cuba today, it was hard for me to believe that such a model of an alternative possibility to U.S. imperialism existed just 90 miles off the shore of the United States.
Right.
And I felt like I had to see it with my own eyes. And so I connected with Cuba Solidarity organizations who lead brigades every year to the island in defiance of U.S. sanctions to bring material aid and to learn about the Cuban reality outside of imperialist propaganda. And I've been thinking a lot about, my experience in Cuba since I've been here in Iran, because it is also designated as a state sponsor of terrorism. It is also under these illegal unilateral sanctions
right. That
are genocidal, that are blocking life-saving medications and basic goods from getting to the island. And going there was truly transformative, not just to meet Cubans, but people from around the world, because it's really an international capital of anti-imperialism and internationalism. And I'm so grateful for the time that I've had there, and I think it really expanded my understanding of what activism and organizing looks like and how important it is to participate in internationalism and exchange, and as people from the U.S. whose government is inflicting so much pain and suffering and violence around the world, that we have a duty to understand the impacts that our government is having and to resist those policies.
Right. And how did participating in the U.S.-Cuba Youth Friendship Meeting shape your views on democracy?
Well, during that experience, I got to observe Cuban local elections. And just like Iran, Cuba is characterized as a brutal, repressive dictatorship, and that is completely undemocratic. And actually, the reality is Cuba is far more democratic than the United States. And that the United States definition of democracy, liberal democracy, where money rules elections, is not the reality at all. And that that imperialist definition cannot be projected upon the rest of the world. And these, characterizations of Cuba, I was just in Cuba a couple months ago, and when I got back, I was detained, my phone was seized, I was threatened and harassed in the airport by TSA and Customs and Border Patrol.
What, is it illegal for you to travel to Cuba?
No, it was a perfectly legal trip. I traveled there, on a license from the U.S. government, but they love to intimidate people. They want to scare people out of going to Cuba because they don't want people going to Cuba and doing and learning about the reality there. And they also don't want people, spending money that will help the Cuban economy. They're really trying to crack down on tourism to make the Cuban people suffer even more. But I bring up that example to show that, you know, these lies that we're taught about other countries are actually the opposite. You know, the U.S. is the biggest state sponsor of terrorism in the world. The U.S. is a brutal, repressive dictatorship. And, you know, another difference I've noticed, too, is how Iran, you know, not being an island, being connected to BRICS, to Russia, to China, to all this trade, it also it has a different ability to like develop its own production, its own manufacturing of, say, you know, like missiles and drones and other products that in Cuba it's very difficult to, because it is an island and because it is so isolated. Yeah.
Nice. I hope you won't have the same fate returning from Iran to the U.S. back home. Tell me, I want to talk about a little bit about Palestine and Palestine Action U.S. What motivated you to be part of that?
Well, what motivated us to launch Palestine Action U.S., I guess I should say for background, you know, Palestine Action U.K. started in 2020 and were active for years and years. And Palestine Action U.S., you know, was completely separate. There are different Palestine Action organizations in many different countries now. It's become a really international movement, but it was the Al-Aqsa flood that triggered us to,
right,
you know, want to escalate our own resistance in the United States. It was not only, you know, the horrific genocide and bombardment that needed to be resisted, and the fact that those bombs were being built in our backyards, but it was also seeing the, you know, heroic example of the Palestinian people under siege, under genocide, going on the offensive against imperialism, that inspired us to also want to, you know, go on the offensive and not to beg the politicians in power politely to stop the bombing, but we decided we were going to go to where the bombs were built, and we were going to, you know, by any means necessary, try to stop them from being sent. And the first action we did, it was a few blocks from where I grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. There was an Elbit office there that opened in December 2021, and there had been many protests there. And then starting on October 12th, 2023, there were several direct actions there. At the end of October, I was arrested there. And last August 2024, news broke that this office had permanently shut down, because it became impossible for them to continue sending their employees into the office. No one wanted to go into work because they were constantly being protest and being scorned by the community. And so, you know, I think we really need to challenge ourselves, ourselves meaning people in the West who are in the pro-Palestine movement, who consider ourselves anti-Zionist, anti-imperialist, that resistance is not just something, some faraway abstract concept. It is something material and tangible that we can be participating in, and especially targeting the supply chains that are sending weapons directly to the Zionist entity. And now that Palestine Action UK has been prescribed as a so-called terrorist organization.
That was so weird. That was
it's ridiculous. It's so important we stand up for them and the political prisoners that are being held in the UK right now under counterterrorism laws, the Filton 18. They're being tortured. They're being held in solitary confinement. They are being moved in the middle of the night. Their families aren't allowed to visit them. And these are the so-called free states of the world. These are the so-called, you know, democratic leaders.
Right.
And so the response and the crackdown just goes to show how repressive and genocidal these governments are.
Right. Carla Walsh, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Of course. And thank you for being with us on another SOAP. Thank you so much, and goodbye until next time.
granted by God to build a house of peace where people will pray, and they will come on every lean camel and out of every ravine for the purpose of praising Allah, to glorify Allah. O mountains of Mecca, what can you tell of the day that stones from the sky fell, destroying an army determined to break the house of Allah that Abraham built? O mountains of Mecca, how was the dawn on the day that my prophet Muhammad was born? How did it feel knowing he was to be the last and most beloved of all, Rasul of Allah, Nabi of Allah? O mountains of Mecca, you were there when the prophet Muhammad climbed down in despair. Engraved in his heart were the words of his Lord to all of mankind. This was his call: La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. O people, praise only Allah, glorify
day to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio, and here are some interesting facts about Islam. During the Middle Ages, the Muslim world had numerous business advantages. They had a huge range of contacts, so they could trade everything from African gold to Chinese porcelain to European amber and furs. And Muslim craft workers were highly skilled, which meant their goods always found a really market. Without Muslim merchants, Europeans would have had no rice, sugar, or coffee. Approximately 5 to 8 million Muslims lived in the United States, and there are over 1,200 mosques. Muslims have been a part of the cultural landscape in America for the past 200 years. The Islamic Empire once stretched into modern-day Europe, particularly in Spain and the Balkans. Today, there are tens of millions of Muslims living in Europe. Now we'll listen to the continuation of our schedule on Iran Radio. We start off this hour's programs with our varied radio productions feature. Then it's time for Insights into the Holy Quran. The program presents a short exegesis or explanation of the ayahs of the Holy Quran. Our radio productions feature will again follow after this. And we round up this hour's programs with Ulama's speech. Stay with us for this hour.
The capital has brought me to one of the most beautiful historic sites in Tehran, Gulistan Palace, which is about 400 years old. So join me as I take a quick tour of this beautiful palace.
The oldest historic monument in Tehran, Gulistan Palace, was originally built during the Safavid dynasty, but later renovated and rebuilt during the 19th century. When the palace complex was selected as the royal residence and seat of power by the Qajar ruling family. The lavish complex is considered a masterpiece of Qajar art, embodying the successful integration of earlier Persian crafts and architecture with Western influences.
Well, it's something which we don't have actually in Sabakia, so. Or actually in Europe, so this is very ancient culture, so I'm very impressed.
I thought it was very beautiful and intricate, and I thought it was very detailed, and it had a lot of tradition behind it as well, so I liked it.
Built around a garden featuring pools as well as planted areas, the palace's most characteristic features and rich ornaments date from the 19th century, when it was a center of Qajari arts and architecture, of which it is still an outstanding example and has remained a source of inspiration for Iranian artists and architects to this day. It represents a new style incorporating traditional Persian arts and crafts and elements of 18th century architecture and technology.
We are in the biggest hall of the main palace at Gulistan. This hall underwent a lot of changes after Nasiruddin Shah, the Qajar king, traveled to Europe. And this particular hall was designated for special ceremonies.
As the main section of Gulistan Palace, Salam Hall represents a unique and rich testimony of the architectural language and decorative art during the Qajar era, represented mostly in the legacy of Nasiruddin Shah. It reflects artistic inspirations of European origin, influencing Persian style. The sparkling interior of Gulistan Palace is what makes it stand out. Mirrors have been used extensively to decorate the interior of buildings in Iran, and Iranian craftsmen have developed this particular art over centuries. It requires a great deal of finesse and attention to detail.
It's for sure something that you cannot see in Europe or any other place, and it's very specific for Iran. And I really like how it's used to enlighten the space of the palace, and it for sure gives a totally specific feeling to the space, which I really, really like. I believe it's really good to look into the past to get inspired and to take those ideas to the future. So it's very good to be in a place like this to get inspired.
But there's even more for visitors to feast their eyes on.
Persian carpets are among the most exquisite handmade items, and I really don't need to go on and on about how amazingly beautiful they are. But there's something special about the collection here. These carpets date back to the Qajar dynasty, and it's the first time that they're put on display.
By all measures, the 18th century was the height of fabulous Persian rugs. There was a large market in Europe for these beautiful tapestries, and in the 19th century, the Qajar dynasty started a program designed to promote cultural revitalization of the local crafts. This prompted a variety of designs. The Qajar era is marked by introducing new techniques in Persian art. Calligraphers of this period started experimenting with inks in an unprecedented spectrum of colors and unusual formats, and started using multi-directional writing with overlapping letters. The building of windcatchers or Emarat-e Badgir was constructed during the reign of Fath Ali Shah. Four wind towers outside allow the wind to move through the building, keeping it cool in summer. It has two rooms and boasts the finest stained glass windows in the palace.
But this is not the only building in the Gulistan Palace which will impress you with its decorations. Each of the buildings here is unique in its own way. Shamsul Emare was the tallest building in the capital. It was actually considered an icon symbolizing Tehran.
Shamsul Emare, or the Edifice of the Sun, is considered the most stunning structure of Gulistan Palace. The idea of building a tall structure came to Nasiruddin Shah, who wanted to have a panoramic view of the city. The construction of the building began in 1865, and it was completed in 2 years.
Now, all of the beautiful buildings that you just saw are located in an immense garden, a garden which itself is a great example of Persian-style gardens. I'm talking about the same gardens that have been registered at the UNESCO as a World Heritage Site.
Historians say Persian gardens may have originated as early as 4000 BC. From the time of the Achaemenid Empire, the idea of an earthly paradise is seen in Persian literature. These gardens are enclosed and follow several simple design rules. Water is omnipresent, and geometric shapes are the secret to its beauty. Kisumish Ahmadi for Iran.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.